I want to be serious and vulnerable, because I'm going to start this morning with a confession of sin, and that's not a thing that, like, that's not what I wanted to do, and there are various ways that I could go about excusing my sin, but I'm not going to do that. I could say, well, other people do it too, fine, fair. Or I've had periods of time where I've had more victory in this area than others. Fine, fair, doesn't matter. So I'm hoping that this will be effective, that I'll be able to retain your trust and move into the ministry future effectively. So listen to how quiet it is. Oh my gosh. All right, so here's my confession. I've been guilty of idolatry. I bet you did not expect that to be the next thing that I said. I'll bet there's at least somebody who, maybe not consciously, but unconsciously, saying, whew, I thought it was going to be something serious. Except this is really serious. Idolatry is the reason that Israel was ejected from the land. Idolatry is the first sin. It's the sin that pulls all the other sins along with it. It's the ultimate reversal of God's order. And it's a thing that I have been guilty of. And I want to show you how, so that you can see how easy it is, how quickly and how easily it is to just take your heart and subtly bend it and move it a little bit. Asherah, that's been my new god. I didn't stop worshiping Yahweh. I just added Asherah to my pantheon. To get to where I want to go, we got to understand some things about gods in the ancient Near East and how they worked. In the society of the ancient Near East, there were a few people like these guys on the left, the rulers, the priests, the guys who sat at the tippy top of a pyramid, but almost the entire rest of the pyramid was made up of those guys on the right, the people that grew the food and kept the flocks and dug the canals and did the dirty work and were slaves. And life in that kind of environment is really, really rough. And you have got to have your crops come in, or you all die. And your flocks, your animals need to reproduce, and your wife needs to bear you babies, sons especially in this culture. Because if you don't, you all die. Which creates a lot of anxiety around the future. So how do we secure our future? If you are a person in an ancient Near East, you worship the god. The god is the one that makes sure the sun shines. The god is the one that makes sure that the storms don't come and destroy your fragile little stalks. The god is the one who does all that. If you want fertility in your family and your flocks and your fields, the god does that for you. That's how religion worked. If we were to look at the environment that Israel found itself in, there's all kinds of gods. If you're a Babylonian, Marduk is your guy. Now, all of these had vast pantheons. I'm just mentioning the main ones. You can mention other ones. In Egypt, Ra was their main guy. For the Assyrians, it was Asher. For Dagon and Moab, Moloch, if you're an Ammonite. And the main Canaanite gods were Asherah and Baal. If you've read your Old Testament, those should be very familiar names to you. Oftentimes, the main god was associated with the sun. If you want agriculture to work, the sun is very important. You want it to shine. So how do you get the sun to do that? You worship the god. And so most of the main gods in the ancient Near East, like the main big ones, were sun gods. They had traits that commended them, and they were the master of thus and so they were going to get that done for you. Again, if you want fertility, you need a god to do that for you. Dagon was a fertility god. In addition, he was a sea god as well. And Asherah and Baal, fertility gods. If you want fertility in your flocks, fields, and family, Asherah and Baal get it done for you. Interestingly, some of these gods do double duty. Storms are scary and you want them to go away, and Baal's your guy for that. And the Norse pantheon had a god for that too. This is how religion worked in this ancient world. Fast forward to the first century. Have things changed? No. We have new pantheons. We have all these Roman and Greek deities that we're familiar with, your Zeus's and Jupiter's and Apollo's and so forth. And then in addition to that, your typical Roman family would have its specific god that they were the fan of. If you're a soldier, probably Ares is going to be that guy. If you're a businessman, it's going to be Janus. Then there are deities just for the household. And the father of the family, the paterfamilias, leads the family in worship to the household gods and the household deities and all these other things. At this period of time, you had the emperor starting to be worshipped. This is one of the reasons why the early Christians, the first Christians, ran afoul of the Roman Empire. In addition to that, you have mystery cults where you go in and they slaughter the bull and the blood comes down on you, and now you have access to all the secret knowledge, all the mysteries. And none of this was incompatible. You could do all of this at the same time and nobody cared. And other cultures had their own gods that would sometimes get sucked into the Roman pantheon and identified with thus and so. And then, of course, there were these odd people in Palestine who insisted that there was just the one God and it was their God, which was a very unusual thing in this period of time. And the way it worked was this. You have your idol, the representative of the God. I know the cooks are loving my idol there. Raiders of the Lost Ark. So you have your idol, which is a representative of the God. It's not the God itself, it's the image of the God. And you direct your worship at that thing. You do your sacrifices and your rituals, you drip the blood, you do whatever, crack the pigeon's neck, the right way, and then the God will make the things good. Because the gods are really unpredictable. They've got their own, hidden agendas, and they do their own things. They're really these inscrutable but very powerful beings. And if you don't want Baal to send the storm, if you want him to keep it away, you need to do your sacrifices the right way. That way Baal will give you fertility in your flocks, fields, and family, and also keep the storms at bay. That's how religion worked. I was reminded when I was doing this of the scary thing is there are people who are young enough to not remember the pre-iPhone era. At any rate, I remember Nate Hala coming in proudly showing me his iPhone 1. Do you remember the ad campaign for the iPhone, the original one? You need a restaurant recommendation? There's an app for that. In the ancient world, there's a god for that. That's how it worked. Are you taking a trip on the ocean, the terrible, scary, powerful, unpredictable ocean? There's a god for that. Just sacrifice the right way to Dagon, you'll be taken care of. Are you starting a new business venture? That's fraught with risks. There's a god for that, Janus, the god of the new beginnings. Do your sacrifices the right way to Janus, and he's going to take care of you. Are you preparing to go and fight, with the legions against the Gauls? There's a god for that. We all worship Ares together, and we make our sacrifices. I mean, the Roman legions would pull along priests to the gods and big trains of animals to be sacrificed because that's how things worked. I think this is how idolatry got started in the first place. Satan looked at people farming and went, "Ooh boy, they really super badly want things to go well. I'll take that super desire and then I'll put a name on it and then I'll have them doing things for that thing." The desire for fertility personified. Oh, now you're worshiping Asherah. And even the Israelites got in on this game. God pulled them, he took them up out of the land of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, and then he took them to Sinai, and his very presence descended on the mountain, and Moses went up the mountain to receive instruction from God, and God gave him some instruction, but it did not take very long for the Israelites to say, "Man, he's been up there for like a while now, and we don't know if he's ever going to come back, so hey Aaron, why don't you make us a god? We need a god around here." So Aaron got all of the people's gold and jewelry and whatnot and melted it down and made a calf and said, "Aaron, okay, behold, O Israel, the God that brought you up out of the land of Egypt." And they prepared to have all of these sacrifices and do rituals to the God. That's how it worked in the ancient world. It was so distressing that God, who was dealing with Moses at the time, went, "Wait a minute, you better get back down." I'm trivializing a little bit, but read the text. Basically, God says, "So they've done this thing, and you need to get down there and deal with that," which he does. He leaves the presence of God, and he goes down and gets super, super angry, which of course you would. These would be the generation of people that literally watched the sea split apart, and already they're performing idolatry. Already. Which leads Aaron to utter what I think is the stupidest human sentence that's ever been uttered and recorded to. His excuse was this: "Well, they gave me the gold and I threw it in the fire and out came this calf. mean, which is profoundly dumb, especially because everybody knows that he made it. Well, why would he make excuses? I mean, even he knows it was wrong. He's the guy who did it, and even he knows that it was wrong. And the evil of idolatry is this. God is the creator of it all. He's the one that created the world. He's the one that ordered it. He's the one that covenanted with the patriarchs. God is the one who brought Israel out of Egypt. God is the one who did this. God is the one who made the covenants. God is the one who drove out the nations before Israel. God is the one who sent the prophets to plead with them not to commit idolatry. God is the one who sent a Messiah. God did all of it. And then we go, oh, hey, Asherah, I'm going to take this tree here. I'm going to hack the top off. I'm going to carve it into the shape of a woman. Then I'm going to worship that because I want fertility in my fields and my flocks and my families. Except God is supposed to do that too. Yahweh your God shall give you an extra measure for the good in all your handiwork and the fruit of your womb, family, and the fruit of your beasts, flocks, and the fruit of your soil. God does that, and we exchange that for this. Imagine how ugly it is from God's perspective to have created everything and long for the worship of creation and to watch the creation turn around and worship itself. Ugh. But that's what we do anytime we commit idolatry. Now, my perception is that we pat ourselves on the back here in the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant West and say, well, those guys over there think there's a lot of gods, but we know there's just one. I'm only worshiping Yahweh. That's it. That's the only God. I'm a good monotheist. We know that there aren't any other gods. And those people over there think that thing's a god, but it's not really God. They're practicing idolatry, but that's not a risk for me. No siree, Bob. We don't have idols here in the U.S. or the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant West. But that's baloney. That's not true. Because I'm telling you, I engaged in a worship of Asherah, fertility. I did, and I'm going to show you how I did that. But to do that, I need to tell a story. That's my son, Levi, born 2010, 4 weeks premature, delivered via C-section. He had to stay in the hospital for about a week. We took him home, loved him intensely, but we wanted to have more kids. So this is my second son, Aaron, who was born 14 weeks premature. That thing you see on his foot, that's my wedding ring. That foot's about 2 inches long. At one point, he weighed in at 1 pound, 13 ounces. Almost died in the hospital, multiple surgeries. But we got him back, you know. God got us through that. And after 14 weeks in the hospital, we took him home and we loved him intensely, but we wanted to have more kids. You guys know me, I'm a baby guy, come on. Except when Annie talked to her doctor about that, her doctor said, well, you've had 2 babies born premature, both via cesarean section, 2 different types of cesarean section, which means your uterine wall is weakened in 2 different types of ways. So if you get pregnant, it will be considered a high-risk pregnancy from minute one, right from the beginning. You'll be on bed rest right from the beginning. You'll have to be taking these drugs, these very, very expensive drugs to prevent contraction. We'll definitely take the baby via C-section minimum 4 weeks early. What you're talking about doing is exceptionally dangerous. And so what we did was we talked and we said, well, we love our boys, and it looks like this is all the children God wants us to have. And so we took some steps to make that be something that was going to be a permanent state of affairs. Except I wanted more kids. I did. I didn't know that, like, I wasn't shrieking that in my mind. My rational mind had said, we thought this through and this is the right decision. But sitting down in my heart was that desire. That desire kept going inside my heart. It never really went away. So in the summer of 2018, last year, Randy called me and he said, hey, you said you'd be willing to host people for Immerse. Would you be willing to host people? Yeah, absolutely. Okay, great. I want to put Titus' girlfriend, Mariah Thompson, with you guys. All right, great. Fantastic. That's why we bought the house. So she moved in, and at the beginning, she was just that, Titus's girlfriend. Yay, we get to host Titus's girlfriend. But very, very swiftly, she just became part of our family. And not in the way that people sometimes say, like, oh, you're part of the family. But not really, because these are my blood people. No, she, to all 4 of us, became just part of our family. such that very swiftly it moved from, yay, we get to have Titus's girlfriend, and it became, Titus, I'll punch you in the nose if you hurt this girl. Because my feelings had shifted very dramatically. And when she got married, this is her innovation. She started calling me bonus dad. Her dad introduces me to people as her Ames dad. That's really how it is in our hearts. So when bonus kid got married and moved out of bonus dad's house, all of a sudden the house felt a little emptier. It didn't feel full anymore. We had stretched and we had gained a larger family, and now it's empty. And then two thoughts occurred to me that had never occurred in quite this way before. I want more kids. I ain't going to have any more kids. And that was just emotionally devastating. If you want to know what that was like, you can talk to Mark and Anna about it. I was so sad. So sad. Because I have a thing that I want, and I know I cannot have it. And I had to wrestle through all of that. And I got myself to a really good place with the help of my parents and my wife and the Blands and other people, Mark Stevenson. And where I got to was this. Could you grab that bottle of water, somebody, and bring it over? Where I got to was this. One, it is okay to want more children. That is a good, godly thing to want. That's fine, thank you. It's okay to want more children. It's perfectly okay. And number two, it's okay to be sad. You had a future and vision for yourself. I would have gone 5, 6 kids easy. You had a future and vision for yourself. Yeah, poor Annie, right? You have a future and vision for yourself that you're not going to get that future. It will not happen for you. It is okay to be sad. It is okay to grieve that thing. And so I did. I started doing a process of grieving and praying and all of these things, and it went really well, except that's when Satan started whispering to me. Now, obviously not audibly, and all of this was not, consciously happening. Satan, clever as he is, he's not going to start with an obvious, bold-faced lie that you'd recognize and reject right away. No, he's going to start with the truth, and then he's going to start tweaking it. So here's what he did. He started saying the same thing that I had been saying, which was, it's okay to be sad, and it's okay to want more kids. And then he just started tweaking it little by little. It's okay to be sad. In fact, it's okay to be really sad, like profoundly, deeply, deeply sad, like incapacitatingly. That's okay. It's okay. Why don't you just explore that emotional space? Why don't you just let yourself live in it for a while? And really deep, just settle yourself down into that pain and feel it. It's okay. Wallow in it, buddy. It's okay. Wallow in it. Because after all, and here's where he makes a crucial turn, if you had more kids, you'd be happy. Ooh, boy. So at that point, if it had been conscious, I would have said, whoa, 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 hang on a second. You're telling me if I had, I can't be happy without more children? But see, the problem was this is all happening subconsciously. In the world of the ancient Near East, you could see idolatry. It's when they take the thing over there and cut its throat in front of the Asherah pole instead of in the temple where they're supposed to. You can see idolatry. It's right in your face. But for me, it was very, very subtle and slow and subconscious. I didn't know what was going on. However, a couple of weeks ago, I was trying to pick some music to listen to, and through some oddball combination of swiping and clicking and whatnot, my phone showed me this thing right here. It's a message that I taught last year on idolatry. Why would that even be on my phone to begin with? And why would it be the only thing? What combination of buttons gets me to that? I don't even know. I had to work at finding it for this screenshot. And then I said, yeah, that sounds good. I'll listen to that. Bizarre. And in addition to that, I have been through my Bible yearly thing. I just had completed reading the Torah, the law, which has quite a few very specific and sharp things to say about idolatry and the seriousness with which God takes that. And so I listened through it, and I had talked about how God's worked, and then I said, okay, here's some ways that you can identify, and I have no idea yet that this is happening in my heart. So I'm listening to this, and I hear myself say, here's how you can identify some idols in your heart. If you blah, 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 if you blah, 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 if you blah, 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 if you can't be happy without it, it might be an idol to you. And it's like this light came on in my head, Oh, this explains this pattern of behavior I've had over the last 8 months. Oh, this explains this attitude that I've had toward this person and this person. This explains why I've been sinning in this way. This explains why I've, because I'm worshiping a false god. I could not be happy. I got myself to the point where I really believed, not consciously, but subconsciously, and it doesn't matter which it is, I really had gotten myself to the point of thinking, I cannot be happy. I cannot be happy until I get this thing. That's an idol. That is exactly what that is. And I've had to do ask the Blands. I have had to do serious repenting toward them for sins that I committed against them when I was worshiping Asherah. Fully convinced that I was doing all of the right things to just get over my sadness. However, recall that in the ancient Near East and in the pagan first century, the way that gods worked was you had your idol, and you did your rituals and your sacrifices the right way, and then the god would give you what you wanted and everything would be good. And so I haven't taken any bulls. I haven't made for myself an Asherah pole, and I have not been performing rituals to it. You know, I didn't twist the neck of a pigeon or slaughter a goat. I didn't do any of those things. So I'm not making any sacrifices. So it's all okay. It was just a deep-seated longing that you just had to get in better proper perspective. Except I think I did make some sacrifices. I spent a lot of my time dwelling on this emotional reality that I was living in. Time that could have been used way better doing other things. I am certain that my preoccupation with the idea of having more children took my attention away from my own kids. I'm certain of that. And I'm equally certain that my preoccupation with that led me to pay insufficient amount of attention to my wife and to my relationship with her. All of those things felt like totally worthwhile sacrifices to make. What does it matter if you're sacrificing a goat or your time? What does it matter if you're sacrificing a pigeon or an ephah of flour? It doesn't matter. So now I have to, which I have done and I'm continuing to do, repent of having done this. I have identified an idol in my heart, and now I'm about the work of rooting it out. The worst thing about all this, however, wasn't just all of that. It was this. God knew I wanted more children, and he gave them to me. So I'm at this delightful age where there are like full-fledged adult humans who could plausibly be your child. Right, I'm the same age as Elijah Bowman's dad. Like, I'm older than Luke Riffo's dad. And so what I've been finding is for these people, it's not, I have a fatherly type love for them, a concern for their well-being that's different from the peer relationships that I have. God knew that I wanted to give my fatherly love to people, and he gave me a whole bunch of them. And I was so preoccupied with this idol that I didn't even see the opportunity that God had given me. God didn't give me what I wanted the way I wanted, but that's pretty typical of how God works. And I lost out on that because of my preoccupation with Asherah. So now I'm doing the work that the ancient Israelites were enjoined to do. You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations whom you are to dispossess worship their gods, on the high mountains and in the valleys and under every lush tree, and you shall smash their altars and shatter their sacred pillars, and their Asherah poles you shall burn in fire, and the image of their god you shall chop down, and you shall destroy their name from that place. You just read Deuteronomy. It is really, really clear that God is not a fan of idolatry and that you need to do everything that you can to prevent it. And yet still the Israelites ran off after the other gods. And so did I. So now I need to do the work of rooting out the god in my heart so that I can return to proper worship of just the one God. And the thing is, I could be the only person here that's ever done this, but I doubt it. I mean, on one hand, it's easier if For the Israelites on this side of the banks of the Jordan River to look across the Jordan and say, well, we want fertility over there, And Baal Peor is the god over there, so we're going to worship the Baal of Peor. And the way that we do that is by engaging ourselves sexually with cult priests or cult harlots, cult prostitutes. Well, then it's really easy to see who's doing the idolatry, and you can take your spear and just... But now, nobody can see it if what I'm sacrificing is just my time, or if the idol doesn't, if the idol's not right there on the table, but it's sitting inside my heart. Really hard to see. Really easy to self-deceive. Incredibly easy to do that. So, what God? What is an idol then? Well, it's a thing within the creation that takes the creator's place. A desire for fertility in my family became a thing that took the creator's place. But it could be anything. It could be almost anything. If we cannot be safe, like really seriously, if we cannot feel safe unless we're armed to the teeth, it could be that there's an idol there. If you literally cannot feel safe otherwise. If you feel like your success is contingent, like ultimate success is contingent on anything other than God, and you cannot have security that you'll have that success or happiness in my case, there's your idol. If God is not the thing giving you hope for your future, just there you go, idol. You know, if America can only be safe if X politician or if X party or if X policy or if X judge, and that's the only way, idol. An idol would be a thing that you devote yourself to wholly and utterly and allow no criticism of whatsoever. Other than God, everything is under sin. Therefore, everything can be criticized. So if there's something external to you that's not God, that you will brook no criticism of, it could be that that's an idol to you. And I preach this to myself because I did it in the not too distant past. And if that's something that we sacrifice to, you know, I think most of us have probably, you know, met the person who we think, my gosh, I know you have a wife and kids, but you're at the office all the time. Aren't you sort of sacrificing your relationship with your family? Because, like, you're always here. Could be that there's an idol there. So in the ancient Near East, it was things like the sun or the master of the storms or whatever. But it could be that a relentless pursuit for this perfect house could turn into an idol for you. It could be that I cannot have hope for my future unless I get thus and so educational attainment. And I say this as a guy who's just recently come through the process of identifying an idol. So this is not me up here looking down on y'all. Maybe if I could only have this much in my 401k or make this thus and so a salary, and only then will I be safe. Maybe it's, if only I could get married. If only I could get married, if only I could have the baby, then I'd be happy. But if something other than God is the if only, there's your idol right there. And the point that I need to make in this is none of these are bad things. I like to plink at, you know, soda cans with my 22. I love school. I've got a couple of degrees. I love the home that I purchased with my wife, and I'm super, super happy with my choice in marriage. None of those are bad things. All of them can become idols to you because Satan doesn't care. He doesn't care which side of the horse you fall off. He just wants you on the dirt. That's it. So he's just going to keep trying. If the idol of wealth doesn't do it, he'll offer you the idol of marriage. Then he'll offer you the idol of whatever, until he finds the thing that he can convince you is the thing you can't live without. And then he's got you. And there are myriad things. We could pin our hopes on political movements or politicians or parties, or we could pin our hopes on if only we can clean up the environment, then our future is secure. Or we could take up a cause of some kind and let that cause take God's place at the top of our priorities. Or it could be any of those things that I mentioned, or it could be any of a number of things that could take God's place, none of which are bad. You guys know that I've been, for the last, you know, several years, trying to be physically healthy And that's a good thing. Health is good unless you make an idol out of it. Babies are good. Jobs are good. You know, I mean, in spite of what some people say, politics isn't inherently bad. It can go bad easily, but none of these things is inherently as such bad. But Satan doesn't care which one of them we take for our idol. As long as he can add a god to our pantheon, he might not even have to, he didn't with me, he might not even try to convince you that that god is the right god to worship and Yahweh isn't the right god. He might just subtly turn you into a polytheist, which is was my case. Sure, I'm worshiping Yahweh. Oh my goodness, I've been doing something else. I took a thing within the created order and I put it in the place of the creator. It's idolatry. If we do that, we're engaged in idolatry. And I'm glad for the sort of sober silence in the room because and it was not fun for me to be very self-disclosing with you guys, but Satan is still in the idol-making business. And he doesn't care which idol you fall away to. It doesn't matter. You could make an idol out of, I like to read my Bible regularly. You can make an idol out of that. You could make an idol out of how much you participate in the life of your church. Satan does not care. Oh my, where did my questions go? Oh well, that's okay. I had some questions that I want you to discuss. This has been a different kind of a morning because this is a different kind of thing to talk to you guys about. So the questions that I want you to discuss at your tables, and then we'll just do a representative thing. We won't necessarily ask each question to be answered, so it's sort of good that they're not up there. Questions like these. We don't have literal idols that sit on the shelf that we bow to or offer grain to. We don't have them literally. We certainly have them figuratively in our hearts, though. Does that mean that we are more prone or less prone to idolatry? What are the effects of it? Maybe you could identify. So use me as an example if you want. That's why I've decided to be very transparent. What were the effects in my life having subtly shifted over into polytheism? Or if you've seen it happen in your life or someone else's, very, very careful with that one. What were the effects on your life? What are the forms of idolatry you can see out there today? And then the gut check questions are, one, what are your idols? What are yours? And if you want to do a gut check question, you could also ask, how's our church doing with this? Does the Western church, not our individual church, I mean the church in general, how does the Western church do, us included, at keeping away from idols? So do that. I have no idea what time it is. For 10-ish minutes, and we'll pass a mic and get some representative thoughts. So please, if you would, if you know that you're the kind of person who I will call on, get some thoughts down so you can share it with the rest of us. Legendary insight that you've got on the table at the moment. And we'll return our attention to the larger conversation. There's something in the human heart that really, just the sound, even if it's quiet, it works. I'm astonished by that. So my preference is not to go through the questions pedantically one by one. I'm just curious to know how your conversations went at your tables. I'm happy to take volunteers. I have a military background, so I'm also happy to voluntell some of you that you're going to contribute. So, who wants to go?
We brought up, we wondered how we could tell the difference between whether or not it is an idol mm-hmm. or whether it's a good thing that we do. Mm-hmm. Like money, you're going to work. Well, is that your idol or is it a responsibility? And one of the things I wondered was if, like they have questionnaires on whether or not you are addicted to your phone, mm-hmm. to alcohol, if those questions would help identify an idol. So, like, some of them were, does it negatively affect your relationships? Does it help you feel accepted in social or peer circles? Does it replace love to a family member? Does it get in the way of work or school? So there's just different questions, and I think that that might assess the level of, this is this thing I do and I value versus this is an idol in my life.
And the interesting thing is, it occurred to me while you were talking about, we go to work for money, you know? We play, we do whatever it is we do. I remember a chapter in the Screwtape Letters, which if you haven't read, I cannot commend that highly enough, where Wormwood says something along the lines of, you know, all of our research has failed to produce even one new novel sin. The best we're able to do is take the good things that God's given them and make them go wrong somehow. And one of those ways would be via idolatry, a thing in the creation that becomes, it comes to occupy the creator's place, or just gets added to your personal pantheon. I like this addiction test, though. That's a good one.
So I really liked what you said about time, looking at time and, you know, the way that you spend your time and using that as a rule or ruler to figure out, could this be an idol in my life? And I think another one to add to that is your checking account, too, and thinking, you know, I mean, obviously you're going to spend money on certain things, but using it as a way to try and identify areas in your life that, okay, if I take away, you know, this Netflix subscription, you know, is it, I can't be happy without it? Or, you know, and using that as a way to figure that out and and kind of do a self-reflection.
Life wouldn't be worth living without. If anything but God goes in that fill in the blank, then that clearly, there you have it. The west side of the room is crushing it. No.
Well, I guess my idol recently in the past couple of years, a recent development, 51%, can't get the whole 100%, would be appeasement to others, especially trying to fit in. But I think a lot of the Western church has lost a lot of its power because they've been appeasing the secular side for so long. They become kind of the secular side. So they believe, you know, for some reason God creates galaxies and universes and he'll, you know, fully restore your body from the dirt when you're, you know, when you're dead and after, you know, that happens. But he can't fix a broken heart nowadays. He can't fix your broken finger nowadays. So the entire spiritual warfare has been lost. So we no longer see the spiritual warfare. So that's why we're ineffective, I would say.
Yeah. It's not like it's not still there.
Oh, it's still there.
You know? Yeah. It's just been driven underground. I was interested, too, the idea of acceptance. I want to be accepted by my peers. I want to be accepted by my culture. I want to be accepted by thus and so. That can easily turn into a thing that's so preoccupying that we lose focus. I mean, if it leads us not to, to no longer confess the Messiah, then oof, that's not, that ain't good.
Yeah.
Continuing the East Side dominance.
Since I'm not running the mic today, I can actually share.
Yeah.
One of the thoughts that I had was thinking how idolatry doesn't have to be an inherently bad thing, and oftentimes it is not, and like idolatry can be something that is effective. Like if I had an idolatry around wanting to pursue my Antioch degree and getting my master's degree so that I can prove myself and show that I'm good, and I have this mentality of like legitimizing myself or saying that I'm this good person and so my motivation behind it is wrong, I might be effective in doing something good, but my heart is wrong. And so realizing that to everyone else thinks what I'm doing is amazing and like encouraging me in doing it, and to myself, I can be destroying myself. And so recognizing that you need to be open about your motivation behind what you're doing so that it's not just you being effective and saying, well, because I'm being effective, it must be a good thing.
Yeah, constantly interrogating our motives seems like a good idea. I've often been confused. Go ahead, Jen, sorry.
So Emma and I were talking about how marriage can easily be an idol, but then we've almost swapped into making independence an idol. Just because it's so easy to make marriage an idol, so then we, like, in our hearts, we're like, well, then we can't make marriage an idol, so then we make independence an idol. And so trying to work through that.
Mm-hmm. Left side of the horse, right side of the horse, Satan does not care. I think this is where I've often been curious in terms of the how could it be claimed that David was a man after his own heart, or how could Moses be considered righteous, or Noah be considered righteous in his generation, or how could, you know, Job plausibly claim that he was righteous when everybody sins? And the thing that I notice about David is, as soon as his throughout 2 Kings, as soon as his sin is pointed out to him, he immediately repents and does the thing that God wants him to do. But you can't do that unless you're open to the fact that you're possibly sinning. And sort of constant interrogation of our heart and our motives seems like a good thing, which to me brings the confess your sins to one another into focus. Now you all know that I need to be kept on a healthy path with respect to my thinking about my family. Good. That means it'll be easier because my brothers and sisters will be helping me. Good. Anybody else want to jump in before we close it out this morning? Aw, my bride.
So the big thing, like, what are the effects of idolatry is kind of what I've been thinking about and has led me to realize something. Some of those effects is you can really miss out on what God's doing and what he's using you for. Mm-hmm. And most recently, I had applied for a position, and I didn't get it. Mm. And what I've come to realize through this week after talking with Caleb and things like that is my biggest disappointment, other than, so first I had to struggle with, am I a failure? I had to think through that. But the biggest disappointment I finally have realized, and you were talking about you were going to do this morning, is I didn't get the job, and so now I'm not going to get the money that we wanted to do all these good things with. So this whole process of applying for the job, I had been justifying that we're going to get this money that we can do all these things with, and that's good, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. But I'm realizing now, if I got that job, it would change my relationships with particular people that God's put in my life that I'm able to speak to, because I would become their supervisor rather than their peer. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm looking at it as like, good, I didn't get that job. Mm-hmm. Because God has something different for me.
And how easily that your eyes can sort of just shift just a little bit off target. So all of those things, money is a good thing. It brings people with needs into relationship with each other. Jobs are a good thing. We labor. Taking on more responsibility is a good thing. But Satan just bundled that up into a neat little package and said, hey, look at this thing over here. You're still worshiping God, no problem, but look at this too. And that I think is the most dangerous thing. Satan's done trying to say, oh, Marduk in Babylon beat Yahweh and Israel, and we know because we tore down the temple and carted his people off. So, oh well, we'll worship Marduk now because here we are in Babylon. That's not how it works anymore. Now it works by just slowly, subtly introducing things into your heart that take your focus away from, like Annie is saying, take your focus away from the work that we've been given and start focusing it on something else that can give us what we really need, acceptance or security or whatever. All right, so I think we're actually a little bit early, which is great. You can go on discussing these things at your table or not. I'm going to pray for us, and we'll be all done for the day. Heavenly Father, you alone are the creator. You alone are the sustainer of our lives. You alone are the redeemer. Purchasing us back from our wickedness. You alone deserve our worship and our praise. Your name alone is worthy to be magnified and praised. And I ask, Lord, that you would help us to see very clearly the things in our life that subtly and slowly draw us away from you, the things that we are giving our devotion to that are not you, so that we can, painful though it may be, so that we can reorient ourselves around your glory and your wisdom and your plan for the ages, and help us to understand that participating in that plan for the ages is the most valuable thing that we can do. God, I ask that you would send your spirit to be among our churches tonight, that it would be a productive time, and that all of God's people would be built up in love. In Jesus' name, amen.